What if he hadn't been Tyreek Hill? What does that police video tell us? How is climate change harming one of our favorite fish? And how has Trump's new insult hurt Haitians? Welcome to the South Florida Roundup. I'm your host, Tim Padgett. In the next hour, we'll examine the controversial body cam footage that's gripped our community. What does last Sunday's traffic stop involving Miami Dolphins star Tyreek Hill remind us about our police and ourselves? We'll also look at some new WLRN reporting on what climate change is doing to the mahi-mahi we so much love to catch and eat. And we'll discuss the deplorable lie Donald Trump and his campaign spread about Haitians in Ohio that resonates here. All that coming up right after the news. I'm Tim Padgett. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Bienvenidos, bienveni, benvindo. By now, you've probably heard this body cam video of a traffic stop involving Miami-Dade County Police and Miami Dolphins star receiver Tyreek Hill last Sunday, outside Hard Rock Stadium in Miami Gardens before the Dolphins' home game against Jacksonville.
Get out of the car right now. We're not playing this game. Get out. Get out. Get out. Get out! Get out! Get out! Get out!
Damn!
What part of the crowd are you doing this time?
Hey, Drew,
I'm getting arrested, Drew. I'm getting out, bro.
God damn,
Twin. When we tell you to do something, you do it. You understand? Not what you want, but what we tell you. You're a little confused.
I'm getting out, bro.
Too late.
The police had pulled Hill over for careless driving and not wearing a seatbelt. He gave them his license, asked to be given his ticket, and rolled up his window again. But when they demanded Hill, who is black, roll it down again, he refused, and they pulled him out of his sports car, as you just heard, forced him face down on the pavement, and handcuffed him. The most aggressive officer you hear there, Danny Torres, has been reassigned to administrative duties pending an internal investigation. Hill was released and scored the winning touchdown that afternoon. But the incident has left us as a community asking, why do we keep seeing instances of excessive police force like this, especially post-George Floyd? At the same time, some in the black community are questioning the example Hill set, especially for the safety of young black men in similar circumstances. What important lessons do you feel this incident shows we have failed to learn, but better start learning again? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now to grapple with that question is Rodney Jacobs, Jr. He's the executive director of the Civilian Investigative Panel, the City of Miami's independent police watchdog agency. And here in the studio with me is C. Isaiah Smalls II, race and culture reporter for our news partner, the Miami Herald. Welcome, gentlemen.
Hey, how you doing? It's always good to be here in the sunshine with you.
Thank you. We, of course, want to look at both sides of this controversy, but I want to start with the alleged excessive use of police force here. Rodney Jacobs, this is the sort of incident your agency, the Civilian Investigative Panel, assesses on a regular basis. Can you walk us through what you believe these Miami-Dade County officers did wrong in this case and how they should have handled the situation instead?
Yeah, well, listen, I think there's a couple things here to take note of. You know, the first thing I will say is obviously this was a lack of de-escalation tactics by the officer that was put on desk duty, Mr. Torres. You initially see an officer engaging with Mr. Hill there at the traffic stop, and it seems as though things, you know, weren't hiding yet, but a little bit tense. But the officer was going through the proper procedures until Mr. Torres intervened. From there, you see him use a number of tactics that aren't best practices in policing or trained in the police academy, to include officious language, being discourteous, being rude. Yeah. At one point, I even viewed him pulling Mr. Hill by his necklace and placing his knee in his back. Yeah. All of these things have been outlawed to a sense in policing for obvious reasons.
I wanted to ask, was dragging Hill from his car that way and throwing him down and cuffing him really necessary under those circumstances, or was it just over the top if not potentially deadly escalation, as we've seen in past police encounters like this, when restraint devolves into a chokehold, for example.
Absolutely. I mean, I think anyone could look at this, whether you're trained in the work that I do or just a normal layperson, and say that this was excessive use. In some cases, even if you look at the disposition of the other officers in this video, and I've watched it now a few times, you can kind of feel their energy change too, as if they may know that Torres is kind of this actor that escalates situations, like, oh, well, here comes this guy again, you know? So a lot of times when there's bad apples in the bunch, police officers know who to stay away from.
Oh, that's an interesting point. Isaiah Smalls, in the very enlightening Herald article you co-wrote this week in the wake of the incident, the president of the Police Benevolent Association, Stedman Stahl, argues that Officer Torres and his partners handled the situation correctly because they were dealing with someone who was not being, quote, cooperative. But even if Hill technically wasn't being cooperative in terms of rolling down his window when requested, do the experts you spoke with feel this was the way to deal with even an uncooperative person?
No, not at all. I think that's the thing that was very clear from everyone that I talked to. Nobody believed that this was handled correctly. And it's a shame because, you know, after the game, you know, Tyreek asked a very poignant question, you know, what if I wasn't Tyreek Hill?
Right. Yeah. And I want to get to that. But why did they say why did they say that this was not the way to deal with even an uncooperative person if he was being uncooperative?
I mean, for me, it was the level of force that was used, right? Like, at the end of the day, this was just a traffic stop. And regardless of, you know, how you personally felt about the way that Tyreek was acting, at the end of the day, as a police officer, your job is to de-escalate the situation, right? And that's not at all what happened.
Right. That's a very important word that we should keep in mind in this conversation, de-escalation. At the same time, Isaiah, the Miami-Dade Police Union insisted to you that race was not a factor here. The union points out Hill's windows were tinted, so the officers could not have seen him or that he was black when they initially stopped him. Still, that doesn't account for how Hill was treated after they could see him. So again, do experts you spoke with who have studied incidents like this believe the race factor did kick in for these largely non-black police at that point?
Oh, of course. I mean, I think it's a very popular perception or very popular thing within the black community that we know, right? Driving while black, that is a thing, right? And so you look at Tyreek, right? You know, black man, very nice car, right? Like, that is a $250,000 car.
A McLaren a 720. Yeah?
Exactly, right, a very expensive car. Uh-huh. You know, you see, you know, when a lot of times what I was told and what, you know, my black friends, family have been told is that, like, you know, especially if you're in a nice car, right? Yep. Police will see you and they want to target you just because of, you know, the perception on their side of things is, okay, how do you have that?
Yeah,
drugs, you know, to start listing things, right? And unfortunately, that is the society in which we live.
Stereotypes kick in.
Of course.
Can I add to that real quick?
Yes, please.
Yeah, so one thing I will say is, and I think this is often kind of missed in this analysis, and I've seen probably more body-worn camera footage than anyone in the state over the last 10 years or so, and I'll say that police misconduct, although it does have a disparate impact on the black community, it knows no level of discrimination. If an officer is going to engage in misconduct, whether it be black, white, or Hispanic, it's going to happen. Now, right. In this case, do I think it's fully just about race? Maybe. However, I think the added variable of implicit bias is what we need to underscore here. That variable combined with a traffic stop and these other variables created the perfect storm that was very unfortunate for Mr. Hill that day.
Right. But Rodney Jacobs, let me ask you the same question about race, especially since Hill, as Isaiah pointed out, Hill made a point of asking afterward, what if I hadn't been Tyreek Hill, meaning a sports celebrity and not an average young black man facing police in this country? In your experience with Miami Civilian Investigative Panel, is it reasonable to assume that race played a role in what most people consider the excessively aggressive action Torres and these officers took, again, after they had a look at him and realized, you know, he's black?
I mean, absolutely, possibly. And this is what I was trying to say here. I think implicit biases play into everyone's lived experience, especially when you're doing police work. So I think there may have been some level of heightened escalation or heightened use of force. And you can kind of see that or hear that in the language of Officer Torres and in the words that he says to Mr. Hill. It's almost as if he was riled up to say, I know how to handle this. I've dealt with these people before.
Yeah.
And obviously some of that is speculation, but I think it goes without saying that race and bias plays a role in all of our professions, to include policing. The
Right.
issue in policing is that when you make those mistakes based upon erroneous lived experiences, it has catastrophic consequences.
Right. But Isaiah Smalls, touching on what Rodney Jacobs said earlier about how, well, this is not just something black people, you know, are prone to experience with police. Your article also quotes Brother Lyle Muhammad, who heads a nonprofit group here called the Circle of Brotherhood that helps black men help their communities. The Circle hosts a class called Community and Police Relations 101. And Muhammad points out that one of the police mindsets it tries to change is the idea that, quote, they're better than those they're supposed to serve. Is this what happened Sunday, perhaps a classic case of that mindset playing out before our eyes?
I mean, I you don't know for sure, right? But from the video cam footage, I mean, it looks that way, right? Because, you know, I think you got to go back to the verbiage, as Mr. Jacobs just pointed out, right? The way that he's talking to Tyreek Hill,
right?
Right? He says something to the effect of, like, I will show you, you know, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, those sort of those that cowboy testosterone starts triggering. Yeah.
Exactly. And it's very unfortunate that, you know, Tyreek was on the receiving end of that. But I think at the end of the day, and I've been to some of those classes, right, and I've watched the work that they do, and it's some very, very good
yeah,
work.
Yeah, as I mentioned, some police do attend these classes.
No.
Right?
It is specifically for police.
For police. Okay.
He,
I thought
partners,
it also involved the community.
No? Yeah, no, the community is involved with
okay.
it, sure, but like it is specifically for, I think, Miami-Dade Police and Miami Police,
that's,
City of Miami
that's,
Police.
That's good to know. Rodney Jacobs, if that's the case, how do agencies like yours try to counsel police forces to change not just the police mindset, but the police training that could change that mindset? How does what happened on Sunday contradict the training these officers supposedly receive now to avoid the kind of really bad publicity the Miami-Dade Police Department is now dealing with?
Well, listen, I think you can't really train out these levels of characteristic flaws in a person or in a police officer, especially if they've been ingrained for 27 years. Obviously, and Tim, you've covered this well, the state is looking to do away with departments like mine that have, at least at the forefront of our mind,
Right.
have been really responsible in pushing police departments to have some level of training, whether it be for implicit bias or de-escalation training. So I think it's really important that we get back to the things that work in policing. And if it doesn't, or if an officer cannot understand
Yeah.
how good policing is should be doing, they should be invited to another place of employment.
And we should remind people that your agency, the CIP, was very responsible in terms of getting body cam usage to be perfunctory here in Miami, right?
Absolutely. I mean, and we worked really closely with the Department of Justice and the City of Miami police officers to get a grant to help with the
Yeah.
body-worn camera program, and then to get them to use it functionally and equivalently to how it should be used.
Yeah.
So we really were at the forefront of obviously police transparency and accountability. And to go back to what you asked Isaiah, and I guess to the meat and potatoes of this question, you know, how do we change the behavior of officers involved in misconduct? And it really comes down to some level of consequence, whether that's losing
Yeah.
your job or going to another place of employment, or a state
Right.
attorney getting involved for charges of like battery or assault. Like, there
Right.
has to be some individual consequences for police officers that matter in order to change that behavior.
This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with Rodney Jacobs Jr. of Miami's Civilian Investigative Panel and C. Isaiah Smalls II of the Miami Herald about this week's controversial traffic stop involving Miami Dolphins star Tyreek Hill and Miami-Dade County Police. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. I want to pivot here to the other side of this controversy, and that's the conduct of Tyreek Hill himself. On the one hand, the police are rightly under an intense microscope for what most people have concluded was excessive force, but Hill is also under scrutiny this week, including in the black community, for actions that help provoke the police reaction. Isaiah Smalls, your Herald colleague Omar Kelly, who is black, pointed out in his sports column this week that Hill violated a lot of the advice black fathers give their sons in what's known as the talk about how black men, especially young black men, should handle engagement with police. Kelly writes that while nobody deserves the treatment Hill received on Sunday, Quote, Hill's aggressive demeanor when officers approached, his disobedience at their instructions to roll down his window, fueled their anger, heightened their animosity, and triggered the police power trip. Isaiah, do you think this is a valid point experts are weighing this week as well as they assess this?
So I think there's two sides to this. I think there's two sides to this, right? On one hand, there is the way that black fathers talk to their, you know, have, it was my, I think my dad and my mom gave me that talk, right? Mm-hmm. And so if you, by the standards of that talk, did Tyreek, you know, follow the rules? No. But at the same time, I think it's important to ask ourselves, and not just black people, the entire world at large, why is it that we have to have that talk?
Exactly, yeah.
I think that's the number one question, because I think a lot of times in situations like this, often the blame is placed on the victim. And so it's unfortunate that we have to have the talk. And, you know, as I was talking to Omar last night before the game, because, you know, I wanted to share with him, like, look, like, I've, from a few members of the community, when they saw your article, they weren't necessarily happy because it sounded like you were equating the blame. And that's, of course, not what he was saying in the in the column. But a lot of times I think black people are, they're expecting more of black people to in situations like this. And that's, and I feel like that's not fair.
Yeah. I never had to have that talk with my son when he was that age. Yeah,
exactly. And that to me is the issue. Like, I don't, and you know, Omar said last night, like, well, being black isn't fair. And he has a great point. Like, it, being black is a very difficult thing here in America. But at the same time, you know, because if I don't want to have this conversation with my kids 10, 15 years from now, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I want to be in a place, in a society where I don't have to have that talk. And so that's where I want to get to. I want to get to a place where we don't have to have the talk.
Rodney Jacobs, same question. How should Tyreek Hill's conduct be evaluated here in terms of how anybody, not just young black men, should engage police in situations like this? I mean, if we're already taking it for granted, as Omar Kelly writes, that many police officers tend to be prone to the kind of quote power trip Officer Torres displayed on Sunday, why do things to trigger it, as he said? For example, how is any police officer supposed to know that when you refuse to roll down a tinted window, you aren't pulling out a weapon behind that tinted window, whether you're black or white or Latino or whatever? I mean, I'm white, but I'm pretty sure that if I got pulled over by Miami-Dade County Police and I refused to roll down my window, they'd get pretty angry with me too.
Yeah, listen, I'll say two things to this. The first thing I'll say is similar to what Mr. Small said, so I'll echo the same sentiments, is, you know, typically when I talk to my sons, or when my sons become of age and they can understand this, is that, listen, you do what the officers tells you to do. I don't care if they tell you to get out of the car, walk around like a duck naked. There's really nothing I can do, or nothing you can do, to argue with a law enforcement officer in the streets. After that, you come to my office, or if we need to get an attorney involved, that's where we do our fighting in court. And that's just the reality of the situation.
Right.
Secondarily, to your point, Tim, about, you know, listen, if you were in a car and, you know, you roll down your windows, it would be a different engagement. And that may be true. But one thing that I will say is this, is that in police departments, this evaluation is pretty easy. Even in the city of Miami, the standard operating procedure is that under adequate provocation, you must remain courteous, right? Because policing is a customer service industry. Typically, if you're engaging with someone, even at a traffic stop, or someone's calling 911, you're engaging with someone that's having a bad day. So you need to do your best to de-escalate that situation in order for everyone to get where they're going safely, right? So it's really important for us to remember that when we unpack this situation, because that is the standard for policing. And if you can't meet the standard of adequate provocation, to remain courteous, to keep your cool, to do what's necessary, then you do not deserve to be a police officer. Right. So it's really that simple. And me coming from a military background, we understand that there's going to be some people that just can't hold that standard.
Right.
And that should be okay for us to say, you need to find another place of employment.
Well, then finally, we're running out of time here, but I finally just want to ask both of you then, particularly Rodney Jacobs, in your capacity as executive director of the CIP, what do you foresee happening now, especially in terms of Officer Torres's, you know, time on administrative. What do you think the investigation of this incident will bear out at this point?
Well, so absolutely nothing, and I hate to sound pessimistic because I am the eternal optimist, I like to say, but honestly, and Tariq Hill said it best, hey, if I wasn't Tariq, what this would have looked like. Well, I can tell you what it would have looked like, because at least in Miami-Dade County, they don't do many internal investigations. I think out of maybe 900 cases, 100 of them get investigated, and they have an internal investigation system where the supervisor hands out discipline or reduction of time, things of that nature. So not a lot of these cases get reviewed. So I can say no changes will likely come for this officer or the practice. And lastly, some of that, go ahead.
No, I have to end our segment here, unfortunately, Mr.
Oh, I'm
Jacobs.
sorry about
But
that.
Isaiah, from your reporting, what do you foresee coming of this?
Nothing, honestly, unfortunately. Yeah, that's the reality of the situation.
Okay, well, we'll have to end on that note, unfortunately. See Isaiah Smalls II is race and culture reporter from the Miami Herald. Rodney Jacobs Jr. is executive director of Miami's Civilian Investigative Panel. Gentlemen, many thanks to you both.
Thank you so
Thank you.
much. I appreciate it.
Still to come, how climate change is messing with our mahi-mahi. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Given where we live, it's always worth repeating that it's the oceans that are bearing the brunt of climate change. Water temperatures in our corner of the planet are soaring, especially in the Gulf of Mexico and the Gulf Stream waters, which are warming at twice the global average. We've talked a lot on this program about the deadly effect global warming is having on our vital coral reef, but now we're also learning that it's driving away our fish. In particular, one of South Florida's favorites, mahi-mahi. Mahi-mahi don't like these hotter waters, and so they're either migrating away from the tropics toward the poles, or they're diving deeper to cooler water, where they could be more vulnerable to big predators or struggle to find their own prey. Either way, we're seeing a drastically reduced number of mahi-mahi in our waters. That's an ominous sign of climate change threat to Florida's $16 billion a year fishing industry, not to mention our beloved seafood sandwiches. Are you a South Florida angler who's catching a lot less mahi-mahi? Are you finding less of it in our markets here? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. This mahi matter is the subject of an episode of a new podcast called Sea Change, produced by the Louisiana public radio stations WWNO in New Orleans and WRKF in Baton Rouge. And it features WLRN's very own environment editor, Jenny Stoletovich, who joins me now in the studio. Jenny, how are you?
Good, Tim.
All right. As I mentioned, we've talked a lot in the past years about what ocean warming is doing to our coral reefs, but how did you get turned on to what it's doing to popular fish like mahi-mahi?
Right. So a couple years ago, a year and a half or so, I was over at the University of Miami Rosenstiel School talking to a researcher there who has investigated the lasting impacts from the BP oil spill.
Yeah.
He's done a lot of research on mahi because they're a very important fish.
Sure.
And as he's talking about the lasting impacts of the oil spill, he brought up temperatures. And it hadn't occurred to me that something like mahi, which are plentiful and, you know, really sturdy fish, could be impacted by heat. And then he mentioned, too, that the Gulf of Mexico was warming up so much faster. So
now, you mentioned in the Sea Change podcast that mahi-mahi like water that's between, say, 77 and 84 degrees Fahrenheit. But now they're facing ocean temperatures well above that, no? How bad is that ocean heat getting for them?
So the Gulf of Mexico, the average summer temperature is around 85, so that's hotter than they like it.
Right.
They can swim into deeper water, as you mentioned, to kind of avoid the heat, and then they will come up to feed. But the problem is, if that water's too hot, it slows them down. There's less oxygen in it because they are such fast fish. They need a lot of oxygen.
Just like it slows me down when I'm doing yard work on Saturday
afternoon. Right,
yes. Okay.
Right.
Now, you went out with a researcher from the University of Miami's Rosenstiel School. I believe this is the gentleman you're talking about, Martin Grosselle, and his young daughter, right, who's quite the little angler herself. Yeah, and he studies mahi, as you pointed out, and he's noticing quite a drop in their numbers. Here's a clip from your outing with him.
Martin Grosselle has been studying what stresses fish and how they react for decades. And now when he's out with his kids,
slow down a little bit.
He's seeing his research play out in real time. That heat wave had fast-tracked what he thought would take years to happen.
They have a temperature that they very rarely go below, and they have one that they very rarely go above.
Okay, so Grosselle echoes that water temperature factor that you were just talking about. How is he seeing that play out in real time, as you say there?
Right. So they had done some research showing that mahi were, you know, swimming in different patterns based on their BP oil research. Mm-hmm. But then when that heat wave hit last summer, he went out with his girls fishing on the Gulf Stream like they normally do. And he said the water was so hot, dolphin feed on the surface, they were not coming up. If they are not coming to the surface to feed, anglers yeah. everywhere know that's kind of how you catch dolphin. They come to the surface. That's what makes it such a fun sport.
Yeah.
That will change the fishing industry. It changes, you know, how they feed and how they exist.
But I was also fascinated by the point that you and he were discussing about how the mahi-mahi have just decided, you know, we're just getting out of this neighborhood, meaning the tropics. We're going to head either to, you know, north or south.
Right. So that was a different researcher. And that was that was really important because that guy, Matt Damiano, is a fisheries biologist with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration.
Mm-hmm.
For years, for decades, anglers have been pushing for better fishing regulations
mm-hmm.
Because mahi numbers are declining. It is very hard because they're such broad-ranging fish to kind of get a good assessment of the population in the Western Atlantic. So Damiano did this elaborate modeling and based on 36 years, well, about 30 years
yeah.
of commercial catch data. And it was the first kind of big look. And he's the one that found overall numbers are down. But when you dive into that data, you see that anecdotally, what we're hearing that mahi are disappearing from South Florida
right.
is true. They are there are fewer around South Florida. But then as you go up the coast, the numbers
right.
increase.
I kind of got the feeling that our loss is North Carolina's and Argentina's gain, right?
Yes, yes.
Because they're heading toward the poles where the water is going to be cooler.
Yes, and that poleward migration is something that scientists studying a lot of fish. There was a study, I think, last year, the year before, where they looked at 150 different fish species and
right.
found they are making these poleward migrations, which is good. They escape the heat, but bad for the environment they leave behind.
Right. It's like Floridians leaving the peninsula because hurricane insurance is too high. But even those mahi-mahi that aren't migrating toward the poles and choose to simply go deeper to find cooler water here, they're in danger too, right? Because they face more predators down there.
Yeah, I mean, what's not clear is that they may temporarily go deeper to avoid the hotter water,
uh-huh.
but it's more likely that they will just move on. You know,
okay.
that they will, they're surface feeders. I don't think that you're asking me a question now that I'm not sure I know the answer, but I don't think they will just.
You made the good point to me earlier. It's not just that they're being preyed on more when they go deeper. They're also finding less of what they need
right.
to eat down
right.
there, which is,
right.
which is again, puts them also in danger. And it's not just affecting mahi-mahi, right? I mean, sea turtles, other marine life.
Yes, we have documented, the sea turtles, you know, the sex is determined by the heat of the sand, you know,
yeah.
hotter sand, fewer mm-hmm. fewer males.
And as you mentioned, this is perhaps a worse situation here because we're dealing with the Gulf Stream water. Remind us why that is exacerbated. Why is the Gulf becoming so much hotter than other bodies of water around the world?
Right. So the Gulf Stream, these currents like the Gulf Stream are one way that the planet regulates its temperature. Hot water moves north and that makes the world this wonderful place. But that water is getting hotter. The Gulf Stream, before it comes along Florida, winds up through the Gulf of Mexico. There's something called the Loop Current.
Loop Current, right.
Mm-hmm. And that Loop Current is carrying that same hot water that's in the Gulf Stream and meanders. Sometimes it can go way up deep into the Gulf, and sometimes it's lower. But that spreads that hot water. Mm-hmm. We may have talked about this before. I feel like
yeah.
I did. The eddies that get broken off.
The eddies, yeah.
You know, these things are 100 miles across. They linger for months. They come off this loop current that feeds into the Gulf Stream.
Right. So we are particularly susceptible then to the
yes.
ocean warming situation on this planet. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm talking with WLRN's Jenny Stiletovich about the disappearance of mahi-mahi in our waters thanks to climate change. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. So Jenny, let's look more closely at the practical effects of this ocean warming phenomenon we're talking about. As I mentioned, fishing is a $16 billion a year industry for Florida. So when we're talking about the potential or real disappearance of popular and once plentiful fish like mahi-mahi, that's not a good economic omen for this state, is it? I mean, in fact, the Sea Change podcast says, quote, if the mahi go away, it'll eat a huge hole in the economy.
So mahi are kind of like the beginner fish, you know, like they're one of the reasons why they're so popular is because they're not that hard to catch. Ah. They are beautiful when you catch them. They turn this fluorescent yellow and green. So for a lot of the charter boat captains, I talked to one in particular in the Keys, John Reynolds, he says his customers inevitably want to catch mahi. Like he'll offer them sailfish, all these different fish, and everybody loves to catch
mahi. That's fascinating.
Mahi.
I've never caught mahi. I mean, you know, I've done yellowtail snapper and grouper, but I've never caught. I didn't. Tell me more about the phenomenon.
They're fast, and then so when you to catch them, they trail bait behind a boat, and they're teasers, these big rubber looking squid looking lures that float on the surface, and the mahi will come up to get the bait, and you'll see them. And when they're stressed, I don't know, Martin said he's not sure if it's stress or they're just communicating to other fish, but they will change colors and become these really beautiful yellow and blue colors. And as somebody who's really likes to catch them, it is something really special to see.
That is fascinating.
And they're fast. Like Martin said, he's seen dolphin, or mahi, sorry, they're also called dolphin. Keep up with a boat going 25 knots, going as fast as a flying fish. And once you hook them, then they fight. They jump. They're really, really fun. And they're delicious to eat.
Well, of course. Like I said, I mean, if you look at the typical seafood sandwich in South Florida, it's usually mahi-mahi.
Yes, yes.
But this makes me want to go charter a boat this afternoon and get out there and find some. Is it just climate change, though? As you mentioned, there's also been an overfishing problem of species like mahi-mahi in ways that add to the problem?
Yes, yes. And then that is an ongoing problem. And I probably should have dwelled on that more, but this podcast was about climate change.
No.
For 20 years, people have been calling for better fishing regulations. The Florida Sportsman magazine, Blair Rickstrom, who's an editor there, has written countless articles about how the regulations are not protective enough. There are the commercial limit. There's no limit on long lining. And these are causing numbers. Anecdotally, they were finding numbers of dolphins were down. They, you know,
are the mahi maybe then a victim of that fascinating characteristics they display when they're being caught? I mean, you mentioned more people want to go out and fish them because of this fascinating profile they carry, but that's ultimately begun to undo them?
That, but the bigger is probably the commercial fishery because they are such good eating fish.
Yeah,
you know, like this Captain John Reynolds I talked to said, he was joking, but he was correct. You can go to a Costco in, you know, Nevada and find frozen mahi. Like, it's fish from Florida that are being shipped around the country and not Red Lobster anymore, but I'm trying to think of a seafood restaurant that probably has it on the menu.
I'm sure there are several. So I guess, Jenny, the ultimate question would be, is there any way we can reverse this crisis beyond reducing the carbon emissions that create global and ocean warming in the first place? What are ways scientists like those you talked to for this podcast say ways that we can keep fish like mahi-mahi from migrating away from us, if not altogether dying here?
I think it's going to become a management issue where if you have bad fishing regulations, they exacerbate the threats and the harms from climate change. You know, in coral, they're looking to breed more resilient coral.
Right.
I'm not sure.
And how's that effort going, by
that
the
is,
way?
That is, they're doing well. The elkhorn that they brought from Honduras are spawning at the Florida Aquarium.
And are they still using Barry White music?
Probably.
to get the coral in the mood? Okay.
Yeah.
Good. No, but that's going well then.
Yes, they are making.
That's good because healthy coral reef are good for healthy, you know, fish.
Yes, they're nurseries for all kinds of prey fish. So,
right.
So, yeah.
So finally, tell us about the Sea Change podcast itself that these public radio stations in Louisiana are producing. It sounds fascinating.
Right. So they, you know, Louisiana was getting hit hard by climate change. Their coastline has changed probably more than ours.
Yeah.
And so they wanted to look at take a closer look at what are really complicated issues, not just fishery, but they have liquid LNG, liquefied natural gas, yes, refineries there, yeah, that are just everywhere. And they wanted to explore the problems, but they also wanted to offer some hope and look at ways, mm-hmm, that people are trying to find solutions.
Well, let's hope we do find them. Jenny Stiletovich is WLRN's environment editor. Jenny, thanks as always.
Thanks, Tim.
Still to come, a despicable lie about Haitians in Ohio, spread by Donald Trump, has hurt Haitians here and everywhere. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. This was arguably the most bizarre moment of former President Trump's performance Tuesday night in his presidential debate with Vice President Kamala Harris.
In Springfield, they're eating the dogs, the people that came in. They're eating the cats. They're eating the pets of the people that live there.
It would be funny if it weren't so deplorable. Trump was referring to a demeaning lie that had been spreading on social media, egged on by his Republican presidential campaign, about Haitian migrants eating cats in the town of Springfield, Ohio. It had become, frankly, a despicable MAGA talking point about immigration and border policy, a very cruel attempt to portray immigrants as overrunning America and killing its house pets. Trump and his running mate J.D. Vance, who's also pushing the cat lie for political gain, have been nationally ridiculed since Tuesday night's debate. But what's gotten lost in the commotion is the fact that more than a million law-abiding, productive, and culturally vibrant Haitians in this country, not just the 20,000 in Springfield, but those in communities like South Florida, where half the U.S. Haitian diaspora resides, have had to take the brunt of one of the more hateful stunts we've ever seen in U.S. politics. And the question now should be, how do we help make it up to them? What are your thoughts on that? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now to discuss this is Alex Desoulmets. He's the Haitian-American mayor of North Miami, whose population has one of the highest concentrations of Haitian residents in the U.S., if not the highest, according to the Census Bureau. Mayor Desoulmets, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tim, and thank you for having me with you this afternoon. And you're right, we do have the highest concentration of, you know, Haitian-American brothers and sisters living in North Miami.
Well, Mayor Desoulmets, thank you again for taking the time to be with us. And I want to start with that really disturbing moment in Tuesday's debate when Donald Trump pushed that lie. What ran through your head and your gut as you listened to him?
Oh, my God, Tim. Well, you know, it's deeply troubling to hear a presidential candidate of the highest office of the U.S., of these United States, would stand on a debate stage where almost 60 plus million
67 Americans, million people were watching,
67
right?
67 million to make these false statements and you know, that really damaged the reputation of the people of Springfield, but more than anything, kind of fueled division and hostile in the Haitian community throughout the entire U.S., and it's very, very despicable.
Yeah.
It's racist and it's divisive.
Let's quickly at the outset remind people, Mayor, of two things. First, these so-called reports of Haitian migrants eating cats in Springfield have been thoroughly debunked and discredited, of course. And second, the 20,000 or so Haitians who live in Springfield have actually helped that town experience an economic and social revival of sorts, correct?
That is correct. And I penned a letter to the mayor and the city council yesterday, just offering any type of support that I could have as I myself being Haitian American and serving as one of three Haitian American mayors in the entire U.S. It's really sad because you have a group of folks who come here for a better life, you know, just like any other immigrant groups that comes to the U.S. and then to have to subject to such a betrayal of just denigrating communities instead of trying to bring communities together and celebrating, you know, cultural diversity It's just despicable.
Now, you have called this particular lie about Haitian migrants appalling, but this isn't the first time we've heard President Trump disparage Haiti and Haitians. During his presidency, for example, Trump called Haiti a, and I'm bleeping myself here, an S-hole country. But I get the feeling this is even more hurtful to the Haitian community here. Is it worse than what he said about Haitians back then?
Oh, absolutely. Because what he said back then, nobody knew. And of course, and as much as, you know, not telling the truth, he went on and said it was between him and whoever was in the room. But hearing him saying that, not only putting innocent lives in danger, I had constituents who had to pull their kids on the side to talk to them before they go into school the next day. I mean, people can afraid to go to work. You know, it's just the entire community is bleeding from this. And we know what his rhetoric could do. Yeah. Because if you recall at the beginning of the coronavirus pandemic, you know, he called it the China virus, and Chinese immigrants had to close stores and do all these. So this is almost the same type of damage. But the sad part about this is they know exactly what they were doing.
Yeah.
And it's sad.
It was more overt this time. You're right. We have Addie on the line from Miami Shores. She is Haitian American, and she has something to say about this situation. Addie, welcome to the South Florida Roundup.
Hello. Yes, I'm Addie.
Yes.
Yes.
How are you?
I'm fine. I have been living in the Miami Shores area for years. My daughter went to school to St. Croix of Lima and Archbishop Curly Notre Dame. She was a Silver Knight nominee. We have provided culture, participated in the financing of this country,
right.
And then we have provided as architects, engineers, and designers, we have provided the culture, the business, the environment in Miami, not only in Miami, in South Miami, not only in Florida, but towards the United States. As a child, I came here as a teenager. I never seen anyone in my family, and I didn't see anyone in my environment eating a cat or,
right.
or dogs or anything like
right.
that.
Right, of course. Well, thank you very much for reminding us of all that, Addie. We appreciate it. Now, Mayor Desselmay, you pointed out to the Washington Post this week that, quote, whenever they need a group of people to bash on, it's Haitians. They don't look at us as people, end quote. Why do you feel Trump and his anti-immigration MAGA movement so hatefully scapegoat Haitians the way they do? Is it just racial, since most Haitian migrants are black, or are there other factors that the diaspora here has to deal with, such as the crisis Haiti itself is going through today?
Well, I think it's a combination of both, but you are absolutely correct. You know, these are bullies, and bullies normally look at you know, they assume, you know, they'll pick the lesser who cannot defend themselves. And I think the calculation was, okay, let's go after these, like you said, the S-hole nation that he famously mentioned when he was
right.
president.
Yeah, no,
so this is sad. It's racist.
You mentioned before that many Haitians you knew after Tuesday night's debate felt sort of afraid to even go out. How is this hurting the Haitian community on both a psychological and a practical level? I mean, the psychological impact isn't hard to imagine, of course, but there's also a practical impact in terms of how this sort of slur affects the daily lives of people in your community, you know, whether it's maybe access to jobs, immigration status, fair housing. Is that sort of thing a concern for the Haitian diaspora as well when it gets, as I said, slurred like this by people like Donald Trump?
Absolutely. I mean, it was before he made the comments, it was bad for us, because keep in mind, we are black, and on top of being black, we are another minority. And then to get this to be added on, I mean, we already been discriminated as much as you could possibly think of. But
yeah.
when you hear someone go out their ways to select a small group of folks to try to pin us, American, against one another, when it totally missed the whole fabric of who we are as Americans.
Right.
It's just despicable.
This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with North Miami Mayor Alex Desumet about the demeaning lie former President Trump and his campaign have been pushing about Haitian migrants. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Mayor Desumet, I want to turn here to a column that Haitian journalist France Duval wrote this week in a leading Haitian newspaper, Le Nouveliste. He, of course, condemns the demeaning lie that Trump and his campaign are pushing about Haitian migrants, but he also argues that one of the reasons xenophobic demagogues like Trump find it easier to attack the Haitian community is that it is, compared to other immigrant groups like Cubans, for example, what he calls, quote, politically invisible in America. We are seeing more Haitian elected officials like yourself and South Florida Congresswoman Sheila Cherfulis McCormick in this country today, but the community is still very underrepresented, in local, state, and federal government here. What can be done to change that?
Well, I must say I'm one of the founding members of the National Haitian American Elected Officials Network, mm-hmm. which is a group that was formed about 10 years ago, right after the election of President Barack Obama. And it's a group with Haitian Americans elected throughout the entire country, include judicial members. We have over 200 members within that group. Yes, we are a small but mighty community. We are an upcoming community, less than 20 years ago when we had our first Haitian American mayor in the entire nation. You know, we still have progress to make, but I think that as small as a community as we are, yeah. we have made a lot of good progress, especially mm-hmm. in places like South Florida, New York, you know, Connecticut, where we have most of our members. In terms of that, but right. our network stands with over 200 members.
Well, that's encouraging to hear. Speaking of Congresswoman Cherfulis McCormick, who represents parts of Broward and Palm Beach counties, she issued a statement this week about the Haitian lie Trump is broadcasting or did broadcast during Tuesday night's debate. She called it a, quote, insulting and desperate attempt to stoke fear rooted in the worst kinds of stereotypes. She added, quote, Haitians and other immigrants come to this country committed to building a better life, not just for themselves, but for all of us. They contribute to our economy, enrich our culture, and strengthen our communities, points that Addie was making earlier. What do you, Mayor, as a Haitian elected official here, want to remind Americans about the contribution Haitians make to this country and our communities?
I think Addie was correct, and as well as Congresswoman Sheila Cherfulis McCormick. If it wasn't for Haiti, and I think the president, the former president, should take a page out of history, there would not be the Louisiana Purchase, yeah. and thus become the entire U.S. But Haitian Americans have been with the Americans fighting at the American Revolution War, you know, from you know the Sable with Chicago finding. Members of our great city of Chicago, mm-hmm. we have been an integral part of the American fabric and contributing a lot. And those, my parents who come to this country, myself, you know, all we know about is to go to school and trying to be better than the generation before us. And, right. you know, yet we are subject to these lies and you know, stuff which is really bad.
Well, let's hope that changes soon. Alex Desumet is the mayor of North Miami. Mayor Desumet, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Tim, and have a wonderful day.
You too. Finally on the roundup. That's the theme music to the TV show that virtually created modern Miami and made a whole generation of American men rethink socks. Miami Vice, the stylish, groundbreaking, MTV-fueled police drama that followed the drug-busting adventures of detectives Sonny Crockett and Rico Tubbs, will turn 40 on Monday. This weekend, Miami Beach, whose pastel Art Deco splendor was revived by Miami Vice's production team, will host a cigarette boatload of events to celebrate. There'll be bus and walking tours of filming locations and a cast meet and greet with actors including Edward James Olmos, Michael Madsen, and Miami native Sandra Santiago. The Miami Vice party, in fact, kicked off yesterday with Miami Beach Mayor Stephen Miner declaring September 12th Miami Vice Day.
The city of Miami Beach wishes to express its deepest gratitude to creator Anthony Yurkovich, cast, the crew of Miami Vice for their invaluable contributions to the city's growth and prosperity. Now, therefore, do we as mayor and commissioners of the city of Miami Beach hereby proclaim September 12th as Miami Vice Day. Yeah.
Miami Vice ran for 5 seasons and a total of 114 episodes, and Crockett went sockless in all of them. That'll do it for the South Florida Roundup. If you missed any part of the show, you can always search for the South Florida Roundup podcast in the NPR app or wherever you listen to podcasts. It's produced by Jimena Romero with help from Polly Landis. Katie Munoz is our director of original live programming. Mateo Sanchez is digital editor. Sergio Bustos is WLRN's vice president of news. The vice president of radio and the show's technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. Richard Ives answers the phones. Gracias, merci. Obrigado. WLRN.